He stood to one side at the sight of our warrant cards and we went in. DC Wolf and TDC Wren, I said.
Nick Cage, he said, reluctantly.
I saw rags in glass cases, rusty medals in presentation cases, framed photographs of smiling men who had died screaming a lifetime ago.
Nice place, Wren said. My old man would love it. Is that a real Luger, P-08?
She was indicating a handgun in a dark, stained glass box.
Replica, he replied, looking at me. It doesn't fire.
I opened my bag and removed a file. Inside, it was a collection of 8x10 photographs. I spread them on top of a glass cabinet and felt a pulse of pain freeze my lower back. The photographs were all of a knife that was designed to cut a man's throat. I leaned forward, my palms on the glass case, easing my tailbone and my breath out at the same time. It wasn't a proper dog stretch, but it made me feel better.
I know you, Cage said. Where was it?
He clicked his fingers.
The Laughing Policeman film on YouTube.
He's dead famous, Wren said, flicking through a rack of ragged army jackets, as if she was in Miss Selfridge. He went viral.
I looked at Cage. You don't know me, okay? I said.
Okay, he said.
Do you know what these are?
He looked at the photos one by one.
It's a Fairburn Sykes Commando dagger. They're all Fairburn Sykes Commando daggers. These are all different generations of the same weapon. I could be more specific if I could see the knives.
This one with the green handle is marked PPCLI. That's Canadian. Princess Patricia's Canadian Light Infantry.
This one with the French writing, Le Commando Inox, see that, was used by French special forces in Algeria between 1954 and 1962.
Laymen think that the Fairburn Sykes was only used in World War II, but Wilkinson's kept producing them after the war and sold them to special forces all over the world. This is about Bob the Butcher, isn't it?
Did you ever sell one of these knives?
He shook his head.
The only place I ever saw one was in a museum.
The Imperial War Museum?
Yes.
What kind of clients do you get in here?
He was watching Wren browsing the store.
Collectors, he said.
The sound of muffled laughter. Wren had put on a gas mask.
My dad would love this, she said. Christmas is coming.
It's 600 quid, Cage said. You break it, you bought it.
Wren removed the gas mask.
Maybe I'll stick to socks and aftershave.
What's the appeal? I said.
Cage looked at me as if he couldn't believe what he was hearing.
The Second World War was the greatest conflagration in human history, he said. It killed millions of people. It reshaped Europe and the world. We live with its legacy today. We will live with its legacy forever. The men who come here, and they are all men, think they would have been improved by war. They believe they missed something by being born too late, and they're right, they did miss something. They missed everything. They missed the great test of the 20th century, perhaps of all time.
But let me ask you this, Wren said. Why is so much of this stuff about the Nazis? They lost, didn't they? Yet so much of the war memorabilia industry is about them. It's like wanting the replica shirt of the side that lost the cup final.
I think the general consensus is that they had the strongest sense of aesthetics.
They had the best kit. Wren smiled.
Yes.
If only it were that simple, she said, not smiling at him now. If only it were that innocent.
I smoothed the photographs on the glass case. Do you recall ever being asked about one of these knives? I said.
Well, of course, Cade said. This is one of the great collector's items of World War II.
A flicker of pleasure in his eyes.
And the inquiries have been on the rise lately. What with all the publicity.
Can you give me a list of people who wanted to buy one?
No.
Why not?
Client confidentiality.
Wren and I grinned at each other.
You have to take the Hippocratic Oath just to flog a bit of Nazi memorabilia, I said.
He licked his lips and said nothing.
Look, I said, I'm not interested in busting you.
He bridled at that.
What could you bust me for?
I didn't know where to start.
Offensive weapons, knives, bayonets, these firearms, incitement to racial hatred. The idea that all my clients are Nazi fetishists is simply not true. Not all of them, but some of them, I bet. And I bet there's some stuff in the back room or under the counter that you wouldn't necessarily put on display in the shop window. I'm all right. Look, I don't want to stop you doing your job. Thanks. Unless you stop me from doing mine. I left him my card and a few simple instructions. The shop went dark as Ren and I got into the car across the street. The Wehrmacht dummy stared out into the Holloway night.
You don't really think that Bob bought a knife here, do you? Ren said.
No, I said. But I think he might. I dropped off Ren at her car in Savile Row and drove south to the river to where 200-ton cannons sat in a little green garden. I parked round the back of the museum and rang the buzzer at the service entrance. An elderly security guard who looked as though he'd been roused from his slumbers answered the door. Beyond him I could see Carol negotiating her wheelchair down the tight corridor. "It's all right," she said. "He's with me." She looked as if she had been expecting me.
Chapter 22. We went back to Neris Fine Art the next evening, and this time it was open. It did not look so different from when it was closed, but a woman with short fair hair stood stock still in the gallery, staring out at the empty Hampstead Street. She had not sold either of the two small landscapes. "I don't mind you coming in," I told Ren as I parked behind Jack Straw's castle.
"Big of you," she said,
"but let me ask the questions."
"And what do I do?" she said.
"You tell me if I'm missing something."
"Mr. Duncan doesn't produce much work," the gallery woman said. She was a slight blonde in black-rimmed glasses, attractive in a brittle sort of way. And with just as much charm as was necessary, she was getting rid of me.
"He's a bit of a recluse, I'm afraid. He doesn't exhibit. He doesn't talk to the press. He doesn't need to. All his work is sold to private collectors. Very little of it comes on the market, but if you would like to leave me your card, I'll put your details on file."
"Because I love his work," I said, not for the first time. And it was true. I'd never seen anyone paint like that. It was a city that I recognised, if only from dreams. But she didn't care what I loved.
"Please leave your details,"
she said, with the warmth turned down a notch. Ren was looking at the canvases on the walls. There was a lot of lush green countryside. I guessed there was a big market for that stuff.
"How does he survive?" Ren said.
"Excuse me? How does he make a living? If he doesn't paint much, and if he doesn't sell much, and if he doesn't make much of an effort, how does he pay the rent?"
"Pay the rent?"
The gallery woman stared at Ren. Ren stared right back.
"I understand there's some family money," the woman said.
"Ah.
We have some other interesting contemporary work," she said to me, handing me her card. "Do you own the gallery?" Ren said.
"Neris is owned by my mother."
Ren thought about it.
"So if your father is an earl, then what does that make your mother? A lady, right?"
The woman had stopped smiling.
"You're not collectors, you're fucking journalists. Get out now, or I'll call the police."
I was looking at the card.
"On Chris Hootlin, Neris Fine Art."
And I saw what Ren had seen, that the Chris was short for Cressida, and the Hootlin came from the German artist she had married at 19 and divorced 5 years later. It was the On that she couldn't resist that gave her away. The Honourable Cressida Sutcliffe, only daughter of the Earl of Broughton, sister of the late James Sutcliffe. Then I was out on the street, gripping the wrought iron railings, looking up. Ren had followed me outside and was watching me crouch in the broken glass from the recycling bin. The smashed glass was all from beer bottles. Peroni, Italian beer. "We're missing something," I said. The sound of broken glass beneath our feet. "Upstairs," I said. "A dead man lives there." Up a narrow flight of stairs. The door was unlocked. Behind me I could hear the On Chris Hootlin arguing with Ren, then falling silent when she produced her warrant card, and then arguing some more. I went into a room full of canvases. All of them turned to face the wall. I could smell fresh paint. A man was standing in the centre of the small room next to a canvas on an easel. The canvas before him was blank. "Hello, James," I said. James Sutcliffe was heavy, bearded, with the weight of the long-term committed drinker. I could see no trace of the delicate boy in dark glasses who would not smile for the camera when he posed in his combined cadet force uniform at Potter's Field. The hair that had been thick and black and slicked back straight off his forehead was now long and grey and thinning. It fell around his shoulders and over the baggy smock he wore. "Hello," he said. "I'm DC Wolf," I said, hearing footsteps on the stairs and then stopping behind me. "This is TDC Edie Wren. Can we talk?"
"Yes."
His sister was right behind Wren. "Even lower than I thought," she said. "Not hacks, pigs." I looked at her, remembering her radical past. Then I turned back to her brother. "I love your paintings," I said. "I love the early ones, and I love the later ones, where the city gets darker."
"Thank you.
Do you know why I'm here?" He looked over my shoulder at his sister. "Someone's killing your friends," I said. "Hugo Buck, Adam Jones, Guy Phillips. They're all dead. Did you know that?" A small shake of his head that could have meant anything. "I'm going to find the killer," I said. "Don't you want to help me catch the bastard who's murdering your friends?" He focused on me again. "They're not my friends," he said. "You faked your death, didn't you, that summer in Italy? The clothes left on the beach was very convincing. But why did you do that, James?" He closed his eyes and released some breath that sounded as if it had been trapped for a long time. When he opened his eyes, I saw the ancient pain inside the man. "Starting again," I said, "a clean slate. Was that it? And who knew? Your sister here? How many of your friends? All of them?"
"None of them."
"Hugo Buck knew."
"No."
"He had two of your paintings on the wall of his home, one by James Sutcliffe and another by Edward Duncan." He looked shocked. "I'm not interested in exposing you," I said, "unless you've done something wrong, unless you've broken the law, unless you've hurt someone." "Is that what you did, James?" And at last, there was panic in his eyes. "I know how you got away with your disappearing act," I said. "They believed you because you were suffering from depression. I saw what you were on. Prozac, Luvox, Lustral, Kiprolex. That's quite a cocktail of happy pills, James. But what were you depressed about? What happened at that school?" He took a deep breath, let it out. "When you're young, you try things," he said. "You experiment, you're a sponge. You soak it up, all of it, any of it. Dear Mr. War, he was more than just a housemaster. He was our friend, and he taught us about so many things. Wonderful things. Artists, writers, a beat. To get beyond the self. If the doors of perception were cleansed, everything would appear as it is, infinite. Who doesn't want to get beyond their sad, shoddy little self at 16? To be shaken out of the rut of ordinary perception. Sacramental visions, experimentation. Drugs?" A short laugh. "Drugs? My God. Drugs were just the start." "Keep talking, James," I said. I could see that he remembered it all now, that it was almost a relief to talk about it. "There was a girl," he said. There was silence in the room. "There was a girl," I said. "James," his sister said, "I'm going to call Mother, and Mother is going to call Burke. Do you remember Peter Burke, the lawyer, darling? Don't say anything else to these people." "It was meant to be not fun," he continued. "An experiment. Pushing the boundaries of experience." He was less certain of himself now. I glimpsed the pale bracelet of self-harm on his wrists, as wide as a sweatband and as white as a dead fish. He tugged at his shirt sleeves, knowing what I had seen. "Who was the girl?" I said. "What was her name? Where did you find her?"
"How many of you?" Wren added.
"Six of us," he said. "No, seven. And she was nice."
"She was nice," Wren said.
"She was. In another life, you might have loved her. The night is a blur." He looked at the floor and then at me.
"Did you ever take opium? I'm sorry, I've forgotten your name."
His sister crossed the room and slapped his face.
"Shut up! Shut up! Shut up! I'm so sick of carrying you. I'm so sick of covering up for you. Just shut up when I tell you to shut up."
Then she hit him again. He ducked away, cowering, taking a step back. Wren stepped between them, and it was enough to restrain the sister. "Who was in that room?" I said. "You said seven, right?"
"Six,"
he said.
"Seven."
"Seven?
Concentrate. You, Hugo Buck, Adam Jones, Salman Khan, Guy Phillips, Ben King, Ned King. Were they all there? Who else was there? What happened to the girl?"
"We were going to let her go," he said.
"That was the plan."
"You bastards,"
Wren said to herself.
"We were going to let her go, but she hurt someone. Very badly. It got out of hand, all of it."
"She hurt someone," I said, and I remembered the morning in the Ian West forensic suite, and I recalled what Elsa Olsen had placed in the palm of my hand. "She hurt someone's eye, didn't she?"
He looked at me with wonder. "Yes. She hurt someone's eye, really hurt it. I mean..."
"She hurt Hugo Buck, didn't she?"
He looked confused. "Hugo? Was it Hugo? I don't think..."
"Yes, Hugo Buck. He had a glass eye." James Sutcliffe covered his face with his hands.
"I don't remember. It was a long time ago. It was another lifetime."
"Do you know how I know, James?" I said. I held it in my hand. I held the glass eye in my hand when they were cutting Hugo up on the slab. Wren said,
"Do you want backup?
I think we should get backup now, Wolf." "We can handle this," I said. "What happened to the girl, James, and what was her name?"
He hung his head.
He shook his head. There were no words. "I think we're going to have to take you in, James," I said. "You're part of a murder investigation." His sister said,
"You'll kill him."
But he looked at me, his eyes clear, strangely calm now that he knew for certain it would soon all be over.
"All right," he said, his voice steady. "I suppose I'm ready to go."
He glanced towards the window. Outside, the evening was cold and foggy, the street shrouded in the misty lights of winter. It looked like one of his paintings.
"It's a lovely day today," he said, walking over to the window.
And then he broke into a kind of run, the shambling run of the badly out-of-shape man. I called out to Wren, but it was too late. He went through the closed window with an eruption of glass and fell into thin air. I heard his sister scream, and I heard Wren cry out, and just a second later, we heard a hideous thump as he landed one floor below. I was already running for the stairs. The wrought iron railings had broken his fall, impaling his great bulk. One spike speared into his groin and another through his cheek. A couple more had torn open his guts and buried themselves deep inside. I heard Wren calling it in. At the same awful moment, I recoiled backwards as if struck in the face, choking on the sewer stink of a man's spilt intestines. Chapter 23. I sat in my car on Prince Albert Road, the lights of the mansion blocks rising up on one side of me and the black vastness of Regent's Park on the other, and I felt the sickness rise in me as Ben King came out of Natasha Buck's block. I grimaced at the smooth Westminster smile as the fawning porter led him out, actually touching his head in salute, as if seeking a forelock to tug. Even when he was sneaking around his friend's widow after dark, King looked every inch the visiting dignitary. She must have thought there was time enough to get him off the premises before I arrived, but for some reason there is never much traffic around the park, and I was early. Natasha was dressed for a date. Candles on the table, Al Green singing about staying together, the smell of roasting red meat, and the perfumed smell of her as she kissed me on one cheek, and then the other, and then, finally, on the mouth. A smell to make a man want to start inhaling and never stop. I was carrying a bottle of wine, and she took it with elaborate grace, as I thought how wrong, how grotesque, how inappropriate. A date, I thought, we're on a date. The rage inside me was directed at myself, as well as her. On the sofa, the dog opened its bleary eyes, clocked me, and then closed them again, deeply unimpressed, as Natasha brought me a bottle of Asahi Super Dry in a frosted glass that had been sitting in the freezer waiting for me.
Scout, she said. She went with her friend to her playover?
Sleepover, I said. Yes, her friend's mother picked them up after school. Natasha bit her bottom lip, laughed, shook her head.
Then we can have a sleepover too, she said, coming in close, holding my arm, looking up at me. You must think I'm bad.
I laughed. Then she wasn't smiling.
What's wrong?
I walked towards the sofa, but I didn't sit down. I wasn't staying long. I took a pull on the Japanese beer and said, Do you know what it does to a murder case if an investigating officer sleeps with a material witness? She took a step back.
What?
Of course you do, I said. Of course you know. She had her hands on me, and I froze, so she stood back, keeping her distance.
Max, she said, please.
Her eyes were shining. Spare me the tears, I said. She angrily wiped her eyes with the back of her hand.
All right, she said, I'll spare you the tears if you tell me what's wrong with you. I thought we were going to have a lovely night.
Meeting us on the heath, that wasn't a coincidence, was it? She looked away.
No.
You don't walk your dog on the heath, do you?
No.
You don't walk your dog at all, do you?
No. I'm another rich bitch who gets some little Eastern European scrubber to walk her dog.
And your husband didn't lose his eye playing rugby, did he?
What?
Your husband, old Hugo. That story about how he lost his eye, that was all bullshit, wasn't it? She looked genuinely surprised.
No, that's true.
Were you there? Did you see it happen?
Of course not.
Then you don't know, do you?
But I do. I do know.
Maybe she believed it, I thought. Maybe she really believed in the sports injury lie. What was Ben King doing here? She laughed with disbelief.
Is that what this is about? You saw Ben leaving. Don't you think it's a little early to be getting possessive?
You fucking him too. Her open palm cracked hard against my cheek. The dog sat up, finally looking impressed.
I'm not fucking anybody, especially not you. Ben came to collect some of Hugo's personal things.
A couple of paintings.
I want you to go now.
What happened at that school?
Please leave.
Do you want to know how your husband lost his eye? Do you really want to know?
She suddenly seemed very tired. I don't care, she said. He's dead. It doesn't matter.
She swallowed hard and looked around the flat, taking it all in. The candles, the smell of prime beef, Al Green. She ran her hands through her hair. It was all ruined now.
You're using me, Natasha, I said. You're setting me up. You're telling me lies. You're the liar, she said, angry at last. You wear a wedding ring, but you're not married.
What happened at that school? What did they do? Who was the girl?
I don't know what you're talking about. Where's your wife? What happened to her? You have a ring, but no wife. What's all that about, detective? You liar, you fucking liar.
She was pushing me out of the apartment, and I was letting her. And I saw that she was as stupid as me. Another mug.
You're wrong about everything, she said,
closing the door in my face.
In the morning, just inside the communal front door of our block of flats, half covered with flyers for pizza, there was a package waiting on the mat with my name on it. As Stan sniffed at the junk mail, I tore the package open and pulled out a VHS videotape. It felt cheap, plastic, rickety, incredibly old-fashioned. I looked at the spine. There was printed felt-tip writing, written very carefully, as if by a bright child. Our first 15 versus Harrow first 15, 10th of the 10th, 88. I searched inside. No note. I looked back at the VHS I was holding, then down at the dog. How am I meant to play this? I said out loud. Vice, Ren told me when I got to work. Down on the third floor. Vice has video recorders from back in the day. MIR1 was still deserted. Ren always got in early. I've been looking on Holmes for missing persons, she said. I started with female mispers between the ages of 15 and 30 within a 10-mile radius of Potter's Field in 1988. Keep looking. I will. But you need to talk to the SIO, she said. You need to talk to Mallory about what James Sutcliffe said before he died. A beat. About the school. Mallory has the chief super breathing down his neck, and the chief super is anxious to protect Ben King. You still need to talk to him. I looked at the VHS tape in my hand. I know, I said. But what did Sutcliffe really tell us? We don't even know who we're talking about, do we? Who was in that room? He told us enough, Ren said. They're not dying because they're rich, are they? They're not dying because they're sons of privilege or symbols of social injustice or any of that Bob the Butcher stuff. No, I said. They're dying because of the past. We found a quiet corner of Vice with a couple of dusty video recorders and settled down to watch our videotape. All around us, young men and women were watching writhing bodies on their computer screens and trying to separate standard filth from criminal obscenity that was likely to corrupt and deprave. Is that valver open? Said one young man. I think it's only slightly ajar, said a young woman. Definitely a grey area, said the young man, making a note. They were friendly enough, but neither Wren or I knew any of the 20-something officers in the department. They change personnel every 6 months down here, Wren whispered, in case it does something to their sex drive, one way or the other. She posted the VHS into the video recorder and pressed play. The remote had been lost in time. Do you want to watch it on fast forward? She said. Just let it roll, I said. I recognised the playing fields of Potter's Field. The tree line, the stone cottage, the endless expanse of green churned to mud down the centre of the pitches. Only the haircuts of the boys were different. It was easy to spot Hugo Buck. Big, proud, confident, a good-looking bully, calling for the ball, exhorting his friends, arguing with a referee. After 20 minutes, he scored a try and preened before the camera, his big grin in our faces. I heard the laughter of the cameraman as he said, "Play, bucko!" And it sounded like Ben King. 5 minutes later, it happened. The ball was kicked deep into the Harrow half. The Potter's Field first 15 flew after it, Buck in the vanguard. A Harrow defender caught the ball, fumbled, dropped it, picked it up again. Voices screamed with excitement. The defender made to kick the ball just as Buck reached him. Buck hurled himself at the Harrow defender. The Harrow defender lashed wildly at the ball. Buck beat it down. And the point of the Harrow defender's right boot speared into Buck's left eye. He screamed. The game stopped. Players and pupils and teachers gathered around the boy on the ground. He was silent now, but the teachers were shouting for an ambulance. The cameraman kept filming, and just before the tape stopped, he went onto the pitch and looked over the shoulders of the boys and men gathered around Hugo Buck. His eye was a ruined pulp. The footage abruptly ended on that last bloody image. So, Wren said, Hugo Buck lost his eye playing rugby. Yes, I said. James Sutcliffe told us he was hurt by a girl, didn't he? I paused, considered. Is that what he told us? Sutcliffe was doped up to the eyeballs for years. He was doped up when he was at school. He was doped up on the day he died. James Sutcliffe was a poor little rich boy who spent his entire life on medication. Come on, Wolf. You're the one who said Hugo Buck's wife was lying. You're the one who held Buck's fake eye in your hand, but she wasn't lying, was she? I stared at the frozen image on the screen. We went back up to MIR1. Suddenly the suite was heaving with people. Swire and Mallory, Chu and Dr. Stephen, Gain and Whitestone. Faces were flushed with the fever of a chase that was nearing its end. What's happening? I said. We've got Bob, Gain said. Chapter 24. Behind the John Lennon glasses, Mallory's eyes were burning with quiet rage. Setting a trap with human bait, he said quietly, each word chipped from Aberdeen granite, his bald head gleaming under the lights of MIR1. Was never the plan. Change of plan, said Swire. I'm not wearing a bulletproof vest, Scarlet Bush was telling D.I. Whitestone. Bob was very specific. Come alone. No tapes. I can't see. He might think a bulletproof vest is a wire. I'm not wearing it. It's not a bulletproof vest, Whitestone said patiently. It's a Kevlar Stealth. Lightweight. The thinnest we have. Invisible under the clothes you're wearing. I'd wear it if I were you. Gain's laptop was open on Bob the Butcher's timeline. Bob had changed his picture again. Instead of Robert Oppenheimer's thoughtful, pipe-smoking skull, there was now a mushroom cloud. In sleep, in confusion, in the depths of shame, the good deeds a man has done before defend him. Hashtag kill all pigs. Where's his response? I said. He didn't respond online, Gain said. He called her, he laughed. On a telephone, a landline. Gain grinned, and I saw that Chu and his techie pals from the PCEU were looking sour. Stick around, boys, Gain said. We might be able to show you a few tricks. Give D.I. Gain your phone, and he'll fit a GPS tracking device, Whitestone told Bush. I don't want to carry anything bulky, the journalist said. It's either a SIM card or some software, Gain said, cutting her off. You're not going to notice it. The only people who will know it's even there are us, okay? But it means we know where you are. It means we can pinpoint your movements to within 10 meters. If you go beyond a prescribed area, it sends us an alarm. Bush gave Gain her phone. The Kevlar Stealth and the tracking device, she said. Is that it? Whitestone nodded. That's it. Belt and braces. What did Bob say to you? I said. I saw the pride in the journalist's eyes. He said he liked my piece, she said, and he said he'd be in touch. How do you know it was him? He told me he would post an Oppenheimer quote in the Bob the Butcher timeline. In sleep, in confusion, in the depths of shame, the good deeds a man has done before defend him. And then he did. There were a dozen copies of her paper scattered across the workstations of MIR1. In the end, she had not goaded Bob the Butcher. There had been no references to sexual preference, childhood trauma, or bedwetting. She had stuck to Dr. Stephen's script. Bob was presented as a mixed-up, homicidal maniac who was operating by his own rules. Honour, power, and control are clearly motivating factors for this most complex of serial killers, and choosing victims who were something less than totally innocent. It seems hardly a coincidence that Bob the Butcher selected as his targets a wealthy investment banker, a drug dealer, and an inveterate bully, and also as a slightly volatile folk hero to the dispossessed. These are horrible crimes, certainly, but they are also a cry of rage in a society where the obscene gap between rich and poor is the new apartheid. It was more of a press release than journalism. You could see why Bob the Butcher would want to cut it out and stick it in his scrapbook. It made him sound like a psycho Robin Hood. He's calling my paper switchboard sometime over the next 24 hours, Bush said. We've got call analytics set up on your switchboard, Gain said. The longer you can keep him talking, the better. But as soon as he calls, we will have the number of whatever disposable or payphone he's using. A landline or a mobile is too much to hope for, but it will give us more than we have right now, and when he gives you the meat, you're going to lead us to him. Mallory was still not happy. I want you to have police protection from this moment on, he told Scarlet Bush. I want two officers to escort you back to your office and to accompany you to the meeting point, where we'll be waiting. No chance, she said. This is the most important story of my career, and I am not going to let you screw it up for me. Mallory looked helplessly at Swire, who shrugged. The meat is going to be surrounded with ARVs and SFOs, the chief super said. There's going to be enough special firearms officers to keep her from harm, and I'm all for making sure we don't frighten Bob away. Then I want officers in the room an hour before you arrive at the meet, Mallory told Bush, and I want roadblocks at 50 metres, 500 metres and a mile, and make sure you're wearing the Kevlar. Bob cuts throats, Bush laughed, and for the first time I saw the raw courage in her. What good is a stab-proof vest going to do me? Swire chuckled approvingly. And I'll tell you what I want, Bush added. When I get to the meet, I want to talk to him before you move in and arrest him. 5 minutes, Mallory said. Fuck that! Mallory visibly flinched at the profanity. I want at least an hour with him. We'll give you 5 minutes, Swire said, but any sign of aggression and he's coming down. Gain returned the reporter's mobile with the tracking device. What's in there? Mallory said. In the end, I went for the handset-based software, Gain said. It's more accurate than a SIM card with an iPhone. Mallory still didn't look happy. Let us know as soon as he makes contact, he said. Don't wait for us to pick it up on your switchboard. Of course, Bush said. She threw her phone into her bag. I'll tell you where we're meeting, and I'll see you there. She left, escorted by the chief super, and for a moment, I thought I was going to hear Mallory curse for the first time. Instead, he ran his hand over his polished skull and said angrily, "And I want the lot of you in Kevlar stealth." In the only quiet corner of MIR1, Dr. Stephen was at his laptop. I walked over to him and saw that he was staring at Bob the Butcher's timeline. The forensic psychologist looked thoughtful. The mushroom cloud was still there. Those people in Hiroshima, Dr. Stephen said. They had been expecting a massive bombing raid for months, but what they got was the end of all things. What they got was a new world. So what does it mean? I said, the cloud. What's he trying to tell us? He shook his head. I'd be making a guess, he said. Go ahead.
The designated target, he said. It's been chosen.
The internet cafe was on the Holloway Road. Ren and I sat on opposite sides of the room while half a dozen weary-looking foreign students checked their mail and Skyped home. It seemed a strange location for Scarlet Bush to meet Bob the Butcher. And when I heard Gain curse in my earpiece, I knew they never would. Ren heard it too. She looked over at me and I shook my head. In the back room was a group of armed officers looking like soldiers from the next century. They wore black rubber goggles, ballistic Kevlar helmets and shiny boots. They carried Heckler and Koch assault rifles, Taser X-26 guns and CS gas spray. Their mouths were thin lines of frustrated adrenaline. Mallory and Whitestone were to one side, hunched over Gain and his laptop. What's happening? I asked them. We've lost Scarlet, Mallory said. Not the signal from her phone, just her. She gave our officers the slip at her paper, Gain said, not looking up from the screen. Went out the fire exit, we think. That easy. Wanted some quality time on her own with Bob, Whitestone said. The tracer on her phone told us she was on her way here, Gain said. And now it seems she's not. The signal hasn't moved for 10 minutes, look. A red dot pulsed steadily in the map's spiderweb of streets.
Where is it? Mallory said. That looks like somewhere near St. Paul's.
East Poultry Avenue, EC1, Gaines said. It's the Barbican.
That's not the Barbican, I said. That's the meat market.
Mallory shook his head. That stupid girl, he said. Oh, that stupid girl.
The hooks hung around the storage room like stainless steel bunting, and our breath made steaming clouds in the freezing fog. Huge slabs of bloody meat hung everywhere in the sub-zero air. I could hear Wren and Whitestone calling her name.
Scarlet! Scarlet! Scarlet!
Mallory pushed aside a great headless carcass of beef.
She's not here, is she?
He said.
Gain rubbed a hand over the misty screen of his laptop.
Well, the phone's here, he said.
And then I saw the pig's head sitting on a marble slab. The pig's head with its giant, floppy Dumbo ears, comical and tragic all at once. The albino skin more white than pink with just a few delicate smears of blood. The eyes shut as if overwhelmed with exhaustion, and the monstrous snout squashed flat and rich with blood. Figures moved in the mist of the cold room, cursing and bumping into each other, unable to find the thing they sought. They kept calling her name. My spine throbbed with pain as I reached under the snout and into the pig's mouth and pulled out a phone, its screen smeared with milky blood.
Sir, I said.
Mallory took the phone from me. He looked across at Gain, who nodded and closed his laptop.
He has her, Mallory said.
My own phone began to vibrate.
I took it out.
Second front calling, it said, and I saw that the blood of the pig's head was on my hands now, and on my phone, and on my clothes, getting on everything.
It's Cage, from the war memorabilia shop, a very distant voice said.
What happened? I said.
I sold a knife.
Chapter 25.
This big guy walked into my shop, Nick Cage said. Well, not big, pumped up. Weights, maybe steroids. A little man, but pumped up, you know.
We had him in an interview room in West End Central. Mallory and Gain and me. Mallory didn't like him.
I'm trying to help you, Cage said, looking at me.
Oh, no, I said.
You sell knives, Mallory said. You sell swords, daggers.
Yes.
Did you ever see what a knife can do to someone?
I sell to collectors. Ever heard of the Offensive Weapons Act?
Cage's mouth tightened.
Chapter and verse. This country has the most restrictive knife laws in the world. Not that you'd know it from all the kids in A&E with their stab wounds, their guts hanging out. Look, I don't sell flick knives, sword canes, butterfly knives, throwing stars or gravity knives, okay? I sell to collectors. I've got a license and I want to keep it. That's why I got a photocopy of his ID, all right? Now, do you want to talk about him or me?
We were running the ID Cage had brought us through the police national computer. It was a UK driver's license for what the PNC database would recognise as an IC1, a male of white-skinned European appearance. There was a face and a name and a DOB. A young man around 30 with thinning hair, an attempt at a smile that never quite made it past the hint of a sneer, and there was an address right at the edge of the city.
Do you buy this ID? Gaines said to Mallory.
Bob's up to his neck in security architecture online, but he doesn't have a fake photo ID. You know how many sites there are flogging fake photo IDs?
Not good ones, Cage said. It's easy to get a bad one. Not so easy to get a good one. That's the real thing, or better than anything I've ever seen.
Did he know his stuff? I said.
How do you mean?
Cage said.
Did he know what he was buying?
He was very specific. The men who come in second front are collectors. They all know their stuff. He wanted a Fairburn Sykes commando dagger, prepared to pay top dollar. I sourced it for him, found a nice second pattern FS made by Wilkinson.
And where did you get it from? Mallory said.
I'm not telling you, Cage said, folding his arms.
Gain made a move towards him as Whitestone appeared in the doorway.
We've got him, she said.
The chief super walked into MIR1, her face tight with tension beneath the helmet of blonde hair. It could have been Mrs. Thatcher getting ready to send the task force to the South Atlantic, horribly aware that this thing could go either way. The crowd parted for her, and she did not look at any of us until she came to Edie Wren, sitting on her desk at her workstation, a man's face on the screen behind her, like something she had just caught. "What have we got?" DCS Swire said. The face on the screen was the same photograph as the one on the driving license, but now it was life-size. Now you could see the wary spite in the eyes, the thin scars from ancient acne, the way he had brushed his hair to cover the growing expanse of forehead. "Ian Peck," Wren said. "Multiple convictions. The first one 10 years ago for possession of Class C drugs, anabolic steroids, and Class B cannabis. Peck was buying in Amsterdam and mailing the stuff to his home address with the name of the previous occupant on the package. That old trick," somebody said. Wren dropped into her seat. 12 months suspended," she said, scrolling down. She shook her head. Five convictions for domestic violence against his girlfriend. She has a restraining order. Peck's a freelance software consultant. After the split with his girlfriend, he moved back home with Mum and Dad." Wren turned to look at the chief super. "And that's Bob the Butcher," she said. Swire's mouth twisted with triumph. "Well done, everybody. Start making your preparations. We'll lift him at dawn." "A man who beats women," I said. "You really think that our perp is a man who beats up women?" I was looking at Dr. Stephen. He had his hands stuffed deep inside his pockets. I believed that he could see it too. "The perp doesn't attack women," I said. Dr. Stephen still wasn't looking at me. "What do you say, Dr. Stephen? Honour? Power? Control?" I gestured at the face that stared at us from the screen. They were all looking at me. Swire was very calm. "Did you ever hear of a copper called George Oldfield?" she said. I nodded. Everybody had heard of Assistant Chief Constable George Oldfield. He was the head of the hunt for the Yorkshire Ripper. Letters and a tape claiming "I'm Jack" had Oldfield searching the northeast while Peter Sutcliffe was killing women in other parts of the country. "I'm not going to play the part of George Oldfield here," Swire said. "I'm not letting our killer slip through my hands." She brushed past me as MIR1 burst into activity. But I stayed where I was, looking at the face on the screen. Honour, power, control. A man who hits women, I thought. Where's the honour in that? In the first light of the new day, we gathered on a suburban street of modest terraced houses, and all I could hear was the sound of my blood. It sounds like the sea, a red rushing sound when it's pumped hard enough. And as we crouched below a little garden wall and fiddled with our kit in those last few seconds, adjusting the straps on Kevlars, the firearms officers checking their safety catches, listening to the subdued murmurs of the airwave radios, that is what mine sounded like. It told me what was at stake: a young woman's life. The jobs of all of us who had let her slip away. And something else, something more personal, because you never know what is on the other side of that door and what it will do to you. The officer with the worn red battering ram slung over his shoulder walked briskly down the garden path. It didn't take long. 2, 3 steps and he was at the door, hauling the battering ram from his shoulder and swinging it at the lock in one smooth and brutal motion. The door popped open with the rip and splinter of cheap wood, and the officer stood to one side as the rest of us charged into the house, screaming as loud as we could. Screaming to pour fear into whoever was on the inside, and screaming to hide the fear in our own hearts. The 2 armed officers who went in ahead of me suddenly stopped, still shouting behind their Heckler and Koch assault rifles. Over the shoulders of their body armour, I could see a sickly cat at the end of a suburban hall. It arched its back and hissed, full of cancer and contempt. A door opened at the end of the hall. We were screaming again. An old woman in house slippers slowly shuffled across the hall, ignoring all orders to halt. She did not even look our way.
I saw an old-fashioned hearing aid tucked behind her ear, as huge and pink as a wad of chewed bubble gum. She disappeared through a door on the other side of the hall, the old cat rubbing against her legs as it followed her. We followed her down the hall and through the door. In the living room, the old woman sat on a sofa with an old man, a biscuit held halfway to his mouth. He elbowed her, and at last she registered our presence. The pair of them stared slack-jawed at the assault rifles that were aimed at their faces. The cat spat at us. "Mr. and Mrs. Peck," I said, "where's your son? Where's Ian?" Still they didn't talk. There was a small kitchen on the other side of the hall. "Clear," said an armed officer, coming out of it. Boots thundered on the staircase. I could hear them moving around upstairs, screaming as they went through doors, and then the silence of disappointment and relief. I went into the kitchen. There was a small garden at the back. Beyond the high garden fence, I could see more black Kevlar helmets and rubber goggles, mouths tight with tension, the dull gleam of Heckler and Koch assault rifles. Mallory came out of the garden and into the kitchen. Whitestone and a uniformed officer were with him. When the uniform took off his helmet, I saw it was PC Billy Green, his pale face slick with sweat and fear, but controlling it well. The boxing was doing him some good. The shouting had stopped. "Nothing," I said. "Did anyone check the basement?" Mallory said. There was a wooden door just outside the kitchen. No lock, paint flaking. I opened it, reached inside and found the switch for the light. Somewhere deeper down, a bare electric bulb came on. I went carefully down a short flight of steps, smelling damp and dust, and then I was under the house itself, the ceiling so low that I had to stoop. Mallory's voice was right behind me. "Anything?" The basement was more than half full with scrap. Smashed chunks of concrete and broken bricks. A ragged pile of rubble that almost reached to the ceiling. "What is all this stuff?" I said.
"Looks like someone dreamed of converting this place into flats," Mallory said. "They have to fill the basement, fire regulations. Then the property bubble burst and the dream got cancelled." He peered into the darkness. "Excuse me," he said, easing past. "There's something right at the back."
"Clear," I heard someone called at the top of the house. Then a brief gale of laughter, like a collective sigh of relief. They seemed very far away. Mallory moved towards the back wall of the basement. There was a scuttle of something small but living across the rubble, and I felt my heart lurch. The tail of a fat rat slithered over the rusted frame of a child's bicycle.
"There's a door," Mallory said,
and he suddenly had his torch in his hand, a sharp white beam in the dull yellow darkness. PC Green was now halfway down the steps, staring at Mallory's back. We both followed him. Mallory was trying the door. Locked. Then the lights went out. All of them. The mains. A switch had been thrown. I could hear voices protesting far above us. Mallory had some sort of blade in his hand and was running it inside the door jamb. I took his torch and held it on the door as he moved the blade left and right, lifting the lock tongue from the doorframe socket until he had it. The door opened with a crack of wood. Beyond it was a metal grill, and from somewhere beyond that came the screams of a woman.
"Help me, help me, help me, help me, help me."
The rattle of a metal grill in the blackness.
"You hear that?" Mallory said.
"Yes." We were talking in whispers now. Mallory was reaching through the grill. It was locked from the inside, but a set of keys jangled on a nail, and then he had them and the grill suddenly slid open.
"You smell it?" Mallory said.
"Yes, sir, I can smell it. The stink of shit and petrol."
"Careful in here," he said, stepping inside.
I followed him, and I felt the ground beneath my feet, rough and uneven, and the screaming was louder now, and it was recognisably Scarlet Bush. And we moved more quickly because the space suddenly opened up, and I was between Mallory and Green when Mallory seemed to lurch forward, and I grabbed a fistful of his jacket and stopped him falling.
There was a ragged hole beneath us, perhaps 2 meters deep, and Scarlet Bush at the bottom of it, shielding her eyes from the white light of the torch, naked and wet with petrol. A barbecue pit for cooking human flesh. A light flared, and I saw a man coming round the pit just before it fell. Whoosh! Into the pit. And Billy Green seemed to fall with it as the flames erupted with a sickening pop, and then Green was in the pit with Scarlet, beating at the flames with his bare hands. The man was small and powerful, long-haired and simian, and when he punched me in the heart, I felt the air go out of me as I went backwards, falling, smashing my back hard against some sort of work table that collapsed under my full weight. I felt the pain explode in my back, and then the blow on the back of my skull as my head hit the wall. I clutched at my heart and felt the rip in my shirt, and suddenly I knew that he had not punched me, he had stabbed me. I touched the dent in the Kevlar stealth that had saved my life, felt the sting of the bruise beyond. I closed my eyes, dizzy and sick from the pain in the back of my head, the rest of it coming in broken fragments. Screams from the pit. A man screams now. Green, with his jacket in his hands, beating wildly at the fire. Scarlet Bush scrambling out, her eyes wide with the horror. Light in the room from the fire in the hole. A lot of light, but dancing and uneven, making ghosts of us all. And the man, Bob the Butcher, punching Mallory in the chest and in the arm and in the side of the head. Mallory going down, his John Lennon glasses falling from his face. His face, without his glasses, no longer as hard as some old Viking, but vulnerable and lost and very easy to hurt. Then Bob the Butcher gone, out of the secret space, past us all, getting away with it. And Whitestone waiting for him in the basement. Bob walking into her forearm smash, the blow turning his head almost 180 degrees, and Whitestone, tiny woman that she was, perched on his back, cuffing him and punctuating his rights by bouncing his face against the ground. You are under arrest, smash. You do not have to say anything, smash. I remembered a line from training days. A formal arrest will always be accompanied by physically taking control. She was doing that all right. But it may harm your defence if you do not mention when questioned something you later rely on in court, smash. Anything you do say may be given in evidence, smash, smash, smash. Bob the Butcher, finally starting to beg. And then I heard someone scream Mallory's name as the lights came on, and I blacked out. Chapter 26. The pain in my back kicked me awake. It started in the lower ribs and worked its way round to the spine like some new pain meeting up with the pain that was already there. A bright bar of winter sunshine came through the crack in the curtains, telling me I had not been out for more than a few hours. I groaned and slowly got out of bed. They had me in one of those hospital smocks that reveal your behind to the world. I tore it off and found my clothes in the small room's wardrobe. I was sitting on the bed struggling to put my socks on when the nurse came in, a large-bosomed, bossy matron, the type that expect to be obeyed. This one was Jamaican. How's the boy? I said, my skin crawling at the thought of PC Green alone in the pit, trying to put out the fire with nothing but his bare hands and his jacket. The effort of speaking set off a leaden throb at the back of my skull, and I touched my head, expecting bandages or blood. There was nothing, only the thud of pain. You're getting back in bed right this minute, the nurse said. I couldn't get my socks on. My back would not bend forward far enough. So I tossed them away, slipped my shoes on, stood up. How's the boy? I said. Now, I had upset her. Do you think I've got all day for this nonsense? You have possible concussion. We're keeping you here for observation. Do you want me to get the doctor? Is that what I have to do? I was fully dressed by the time she came back with the doctor. Fully dressed apart from my socks. The doctor was young and Indian, far too tired and busy to argue with me. Or too experienced, but he clearly thought I was stupid. I'm not discharging you, he said. Is that quite clear? You're leaving at your own risk. I get it. Where's the boy? Intensive care unit, top floor. Let me take you.
PC Green slept the sleep of the heavily drugged. Both his hands were wrapped in bandages. There was an IV drip by his side. That was it. Just his hands. But it was probably enough to end his life as a copper. He has second-degree burns on both hands, the doctor said. That means the burns penetrated the deeper skin. But as far as we can tell, there's no damage to muscle and bone. When he's well enough to be moved, we'll get him down to the Queen Victoria in West Sussex. It's the best burns hospital in the southeast of England. The doctor turned to leave. He's a very brave young man, he said, almost as an afterthought. I thought of the day I met Billy Green, almost unable to stand after a look at his first body, and the raw shame he had felt when they had made him a canteen cowboy. I wondered if he knew how much good stuff there was inside him, and I wondered how he would make a living for the rest of his life. Then I went to work. They had Bob the Butcher in an interview room. In the observation room, you could watch through a one-way mirror or on a CCTV feed. There were lots of people I didn't know crowding in front of the mirror. I looked up at the screen. Whitestone and Gain were sitting across from Bob and his lawyer. She was pretty and prim, dressed in business black. The lawyers are getting younger, I thought. Bob had a broken nose and two black eyes that came with it, but none of it had wiped the smirk from his face. He looked like a cocky little ape. Ian Peck, Whitestone said, and her voice seemed changed as it came through the speaker. We are charging you with murder. I couldn't believe what I was hearing. But it's not him, I said. Some of the crowd standing in front of the mirror turned to look at me, but then they looked away. This is bullshit, I said. There was a big duty sergeant on the door of the interview room. You can't go in there, he said, as I came towards him. I shoved him aside. He didn't fight back. They all looked up as I came in. Whitestone and Gain, Bob and his pretty lawyer. Somebody said my name. I reached in my pocket and took out the FS commando dagger I had borrowed from Carol at the Imperial War Museum. It clattered across the table. Show me how you did it, I said. The duty sergeant was in the room now, and after getting the nod from Whitestone, he put his hands on me. I pushed him away. He was a stronger man than me, but he held back. The lawyer was on her feet, whining about some legal point that I didn't quite catch. The pain was in my spine and my skull and directly behind my eyes. The knife was right in front of Bob. Come on, tough guy, I said. Show me how you cut all those throats, you lying bastard, you fucking fantasist, you pathetic little man. Gain was shouting at me. They were all shouting at me, apart from Bob. He looked at me and at the knife and back at me as if weighing something in his mind. He licked his lips. He stood up. The room suddenly fell silent. Come on, I said, quietly now, and I smiled to give him encouragement. Show me how you did it. Bob, Peck, whatever his name was, picked up the knife. They all started shouting again. There were hands on me, and my hands were shoving them away, and Bob was looking at me with the knife in his hand. He essayed a slashing movement in slow motion. I'll cut them. I stepped forward. You lying piece of shit, I said. I took his wrist in one fist, punched his bicep with the other. The knife fell to the table. Wolf, Whitestone said. Max, please listen to me. He didn't kill those men, I said. Hugo Buck, Adam Jones, Guy Phillips, I'm telling you, he doesn't know how. It's not him. Then I saw the tears in Whitestone's eyes. We're arresting him for the murder of DCI Mallory, she said. He bled out on the way to the hospital. The duty sergeant was holding me now. I'm sorry, Max, Whitestone said. The boss didn't make it. MIR1 was deserted apart from Wren. She looked up as I walked in. You have to see this, Wolf. I walked to the window and stared down at Savile Row. I thought of Margaret Mallory and how she had told me that Scout and I were a family when it felt like the entire world wanted to tell us something else, that we were not a real family at all. And the tears came then, blurring the traffic on the street far below and twisting my mouth into a rictus of raw, hopeless grief. They would have told her by now, I thought. She would know that her husband was never coming home again by now. She would be alone in the small house in Pimlico with her dog
and her photographs and her memories and her smashed heart. The knowledge choked up my throat and clawed at my insides and made my useless tears feel as though they were without end.
Max, Ren said.
I looked out across the rooftops of Savile Row. I wiped my eyes with the palm of my hands. I didn't turn round. D.C. Mallory died, I said, and my voice sounded strange to me, as if I was somebody else now. Stab wound in the neck, dead before they could get him to the hospital.
I know, she said. He was the kindest man I ever met, and the best copper, but you really need to see this. It's Bob's last post online, before we went in and got him. Are you listening to me?
I shook my head. No. I'm not listening to you, Edie. I don't care. Whatever it is, I really don't care. I don't want to see it. I don't care what he said.
You need to, Max, because the killer is still out there, because a world full of vicious little creeps is still out there. Will you please look at me?
Silence. Then Ren was suddenly by my side, dragging me to her workstation.
Look, will you?
She said, not gently. I looked. The final message on Bob the Butcher's timeline. There was no picture of Robert Oppenheimer. There was no mushroom cloud. In their place was a small black and white photograph. At first sight, it looked like nothing. An abstract little squiggle of broken planes. But when I looked closer, I saw that it was a city. It was an entire city, destroyed in an instant. My eye flicked across the hashtag, like a command to his 1 million followers. Hashtag, kill all pigs. And then I read the message, and I did not understand, so I read it again. The rhythm of the numbers and words so familiar to me that at first I thought they were not on the screen but only in my head.
Isn't that your home address? Ren said.
I was gone. They were coming back from school, Scout and Mrs. Murphy and Stan. My daughter and Mrs. Murphy looking down at the dog and laughing, Stan trotting happily by their side, something in his mouth, scrap of bagel. The smiles vanishing when they saw me.
What's wrong?
Mrs. Murphy said. We have to go, I said. I'm sorry. I got Scout and Stan into the back of the X5, told Scout to put her seatbelt on, and then I drove, pushing down hard, just ahead of the evening rush. Mrs. Murphy standing on the street in my rearview mirror watching us go.
But where are we going?
Scout said as we crossed Waterloo Bridge. We're going to see your mother, I said. She was standing on the lawn of a house on a road in a part of town where you could believe that nothing bad ever happened. There was a small toddler crawling at her feet and a baby growing inside her. Not my children. From her new man. Anne. It is such an ordinary, old-fashioned English name, and I do not think I will ever be able to hear it without it pulling at my heart. Anne. 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 You might not believe it. I could hardly believe it myself, but there had been a world not so long ago when we were as close to each other as we had been to anyone we had ever known in our young lives, when we laughed all the time, when a good life together was before us, when every night we lit a candle in the corner of our bedroom because we were unable to sleep, because it would have meant a kind of parting for a few hours. And now all that was gone. Now that is all over, she told me, with one small stroke of the belly that was round with another man's child. Anne, I thought. And looking at her now on the lawn, happy in this new place without me, I was shocked by something that I could not admit was the remains of our love. You remember the pain and the anger and the grief of coming apart. You remember the raised voices and worries about money and the tears of a woman who finds that she is living a different life to the one she was expecting. You remember all of that. And you remember the letter that came 2 days after she said she had to go to stay with her parents to clear her head.
Dear Max, I'm so sorry, but I have to go. I never wanted this to happen, but I love him, and I'm expecting his baby. He has moved, so don't try looking for him. You remember all of that, but you forget the love. It is a shock to be reminded of it, to admit to yourself that it existed at all, and perhaps still does. I was parked across the road from her house, on a beautiful street in a leafy South London suburb. Scout and the dog slept on the back seat. I did not wake them. And when another car pulled into the drive and another man got out, and Anne smiled and kissed him on the mouth, I knew I was not going to. I watched them go back inside the house, the new man with his arm around Anne's pregnant waist. She looked straight at me as she closed the door, but of course by then it was far too late for anything. What about Scout? People sometimes ask me how a mother could leave a child. All I can say is, some people get a new home, and some people get a new family. And some people, mostly they are men, but not always, they make a lifetime of excuses for themselves, and they do what my wife did. They get a new life. Panic drove me out there. Reality drove me back. But as the night fell black and cold, I still wanted the same thing. I wanted my daughter to be safe. And as I drove back to Smithfield, I saw that the safest place in the world for Scout would always be with me. Because I would kill for her, and I would die for her. I would do anything for Scout, because Scout was my everything. There was a crowd outside our apartment block. Friday night, men and women, red faces and white teeth, loud and laughing, bottles and glasses in their hands, making no attempt to move out of the way for a man with a sleeping child in his arms and a dog on a lead beside him. I barged my way through them, sharp elbows and dipped shoulders, putting my weight into it, daring them to say something, to do something, to reveal themselves, to let me know they were for me, they had come for me, and now was the time. But there was blood in my eyes, murder in my face, and they said nothing. They got out of my way. Across the street from our loft, the men of the meat market were just going to work as I put Scout to bed without her waking. Stan hopped up beside her, curled against her warmth, and I left them to their rest. But I watched from the window, waiting for someone wicked to come for us, knowing at last that pure evil was out there, knowing we would meet one day soon. And I saw that the lights of the meat market burned all night long, wiping out the sky and blinding the stars. December. Lost Contacts. Chapter 27. 2 weeks later, she came to see me. Anne, my ex-wife. Surprise visit. Her old set of keys got her through the communal street-level door, but they didn't work on our front door because I'd changed the locks when she left me. I heard her key rattling in the lock, and I saw her through the spy hole. It took me a while to unbolt the door. Then she was standing there, a knockout, basically. The same woman, but changed by all the time that had gone by, all the time we had not shared. Hello, Max. Anne. She wore no makeup apart from a light touch of war paint on her lips. The light from the hall caught her shoulder-length hair, and there was one single strand of silver running through the dark brown. She was dark-eyed, pale-skinned, and you could see where Scout got the heartbreaking curve of her face.